Hayes versus the City of Chicago. And it's Mr. Lovey. How are you?
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am John Lovey, and I represent the Ortiz-Maymolina family. This should not have been a controversial failure to provide medical care claim. They took away this woman's medicine. She was very ill. She told them, I have serious medical needs. Her lawyer sees her the next day. He's a layperson. It's obvious to him she is an unmedicated diabetic and that she can't even communicate well with him. He says to the jailers, you need to get this woman to the hospital.
Well, you know, of course, the medical examiner concluded that she died of opiate intoxication after ingesting the packets of heroin. And there's some evidence in the record that she was asked repeatedly if she wanted to go to the hospital. And each time she declined the offer, and the city argues that holding it liable for her death under these circumstances would offend public policy. At the very least, why should we require the city to take her to the hospital if she said multiple times that she didn't want to go and didn't need to go?
Well, let me address the points in order. The first was that the medical examiner has this opinion. He's entitled to it. He's a forensic pathologist. He says, I've looked at the evidence. This is my opinion. But Dr. Edelman, of course, looked at the evidence and looked at much more evidence. He looked at her medical records, her prescription list, and he reached a different opinion. And obviously, you don't have to decide which one is right. Juries decide that. As for her request to go to the hospital, they asked her when she first got there, do you need hospitalization? And she said, no. There is no evidence in this record that they repeatedly asked her. In fact, the evidence is the opposite. The prisoners say she was begging to go to the hospital.
Well, did the officers testify? I mean, maybe there's a dispute in fact, but I thought the officers did testify that they offered on a couple of occasions.
Well, I don't agree. I think the record shows that they asked her at the beginning, and then there's one officer that claims, and the reason they're sort of fudgy on that is because they say she was fine. I mean, why would they be saying to her, hey, do you need to go to the hospital? They're not saying that. They're saying she presented no need to have to go to the hospital. So it is not their story that they were saying to her, are you okay? Their story is she was fine. And the prisoners are saying she was saying, I need to go to the hospital,
well,
and that she was being ignored.
Well, of course, the Carroll statements kept changing.
Well, we completely disagree with that characterization. Vaquero testifies, I've always said the same thing. OPS, the city's own investigators, wrote down that she said something that was good for the city, and maybe the jury will accept that the police investigators got it right, but Vaquero says, I said from the start that this woman's in distress and that she needs medical attention and that they laughed at me and that they ignored me. And her testimony, which the jury is entitled to credit for summary judgment, is that she said, guards, this woman is stopping breathing, she's not doing well, and they laughed at her, and they told her to shut the F up. And then, when she slipped away for good and stopped breathing, and Vaquero became very upset, she again summoned the guards, and they again ignored her, even though she could hear them. So it is not an answer to say, well, the police statements say that Vaquero didn't give a very persuasive statement. Obviously, if they want to impeach Vaquero at trial, they're entitled. But they need to persuade Your Honors that it was an abuse of discretion to consider Vaquero's deposition, and they can't do that. I want to turn to the medical evidence because the district court properly found that at least some of these officers acted unreasonably.
Before you get too deeply into the medical evidence, I'm interested in your view on whether it is relevant what was causing the observable distress. Does it actually make any difference whether it was the thyroid problem or the deprivation of insulin or exposure to opiates or anything else?
The answer is no, because we have a forensic pathologist that says, I've looked at the evidence, I've looked at the medical records, all the autopsy stuff, all the witness statements, and I believe that she died from not having her diabetes medicines and her thyroid medicines. But even if you credit the medical examiners that it was, in fact, related to opium, although Dr. Edelman says it wasn't opium and she had, in fact, an analgesic amount in her system and she didn't die from that. And the medical examiner concedes that it was a therapeutic amount. But even if it had something to do with opium, Dr. Carter's opinion was ignored by the district court. It wasn't barred. It was just flat out ignored.
What do you think differentiates an admissible opinion by a forensic pathologist from an inadmissible opinion?
That's a good question, because obviously forensic pathologists every day walk into courtrooms and they say, look, the death is something of a conundrum. I can't interview the deceased, but I'm going to look at the evidence, and here is my opinion. And that testimony is admissible in courtrooms every day. Here, this is admissible testimony. He had the full picture. He had her medical records. He had her prescription list. This is a forensic pathologist with 40 years experience who's done 1,000 autopsies. It is his job to opine on the cause of death from the available evidence. And he says here, this is not a complicated question. She was taking glucotrol, 10 milligrams daily, glipizide, furosemide, potassium chloride, cinthoride. Her medical records show she's an uncontrolled diabetic with a brittle diabetic, and without these medicines, without the doses she was needing, she would slip into a metabolic coma, acidosis, her breathing would become strained, and she would die.
Now, so I take it I'm looking at all these different reports that Dr. Edelman filed. It's the March 6, 2007 report that's got the most comprehensive list of what he reviewed.
That's true, Your Honor, but the district court allowed us, and we properly were allowed to use all the reports. You know, we've explained in our brief why he had to do it in pieces, because they withheld the discovery, and then they convinced the judge to do discovery stays, so this trickled out. But so we are entitled to rely on all the reports, but there is that report which lists all the medications, and the district court just got it wrong.
So you think the district court just made a mistake in thinking that
flat out made a mistake.
This information was not before Dr. Edelman.
And if you take away nothing else from my oral argument, it is why is it that the district court concluded that we can't present this qualified forensic pathologist who's applying a standard methodology.
Bottom line, what you're saying is that both the district court and the city demanded a much higher degree of certainty than it is realistic to expect under the circumstances, right?
I think that actually gives them too much credit. Because this medical examiner says, this is my opinion, I do this all the time, I've got evidence to support it. They said, nope, it's unreliable for four reasons, two of which are just flat wrong. As you pointed out, he said you didn't look at the medical records, but he did look at the medical records. The district court said there's no ketones, but nobody looked for ketones. Just flat out wrong. The district court got it backwards. There's the thing about post-mortem glucose levels, which is a wash, because glucose levels don't, you know, drop after death. And there's this nonsense about the respirations. When Dr. Edelman gave that answer saying, well, I don't have a tape recording of her breathing. I can't say there was respirations. Then the two witnesses got deposed, and they said she was labored breathing. She was.
Yeah, I want to ask you something. I want to ask you if the record's going to help us in any, you know, realistic way regarding prisoners bringing medication in with them. I can see all sorts of problems, you know, prisoners selling it, prisoners taking far more than they ought to. And don't worry about the clock. I know your time was cut back, but we're going to give you the time you need.
Thank you.
What's the evidence in the record going to tell us about prisoners bringing in medications?
The judge granted their motion to cut off that discovery. We wanted to prove a Monell claim. They said, don't prove a Monell claim. We will stipulate to the city's liability if you prove a constitutional violation against any employee. And there's a transcript that is not in the briefs that I'd like to cite. It's 214 record, and the relevant pages are 3 through 5. That's when the city lays out its explanation of why we shouldn't try the Monell claim. The Monell claim was barred, it was bifurcated, whatever you want to call it. Your Honors, it's not for us to say, is this a dumb policy or a good policy? You know, but if you're going
to... I'm asking you, what is the policy?
The policy is no meds in the lockup.
Ever.
No meds in the lockup. Now,
can you see a reason for that?
I suppose, and again, we didn't...
No. Can you see a reason? Is that a rational policy?
To me, if you're going to take a diabetic and say you get no medicines on the 24th, and she's dead on the 26th, and sorry, we don't allow medicines in the jail, that's a bad policy. The reason that they can rationalize it and make it make some sense is because here's why. They say, as soon as anybody says, I need my meds or I'm in trouble, we get them to the hospital. We get them their meds. The policy only works. No meds in the lockup if you're responsive to people who, when they're on intake, they say, look, I have a serious medical need. I need my medications. And if those people then say, I'm getting woozy, I'm getting, you know, people objectively, they're slipping into a coma, then you have to do something about it. So to answer your question directly, the policy makes little sense unless you're going to be very responsive when people need their medicines and need their medications. And here it's a fact dispute because the prisoners and the lawyers are saying, we said, look, you're not going to give her medicines. She needs medical attention. And they flat out didn't give it to her. So, again, the district court found that at least some of these defendants acted unreasonably, and that was not an abuse of discretion. That brings us back to Dr. Adelman. Why did he bar Dr. Adelman? I mean, it's not a wild and crazy hypothesis that if you take a brittle diabetic who the medical records show her levels are all over the place, and Dr. Adelman says, I've been doing this for 40 years, she needs these medicines or she's going to go into a coma and die. And it's never been clear to me why we even needed an expert. Lay people know if you deprive seriously ill diabetics of their medicines, that's going to create a problem. And when they begin to slip and descend, that's going to create a problem. So why did the district court bar Dr. Adelman? Four reasons have been given in their brief. The first two are wrong, that he didn't look at the medical records and that there are no ketones. Just flat wrong. The third one is post-mortem glucose levels diminish after death, but both sides are agreeing on that one. You can't read anything into the post-mortem glucose levels because after death they reduce, so we don't know. So that's a wash. And then there's this respiration argument that Dr. Adelman was deposed before the witnesses were deposed, and he says, I can't tell you if she was labored breathing. But then, when the witnesses got deposed, they described exactly these Cas-Mall respirations. That's it. Okay. There is no other reason the district court offered or that they offered in their briefs why Dr. Adelman should have been barred. So, and to answer your question, you know, well, was Dr. Adelman qualified? There's no question he's qualified. There's no question he used the methodology he's used thousands of times. They'd have to persuade you that it wasn't an abuse of discretion to bar him as unreliable. This isn't junk science. This is not a counterintuitive science. This is saying, I'm a forensic pathologist, I'm qualified, I looked at her medical records, I looked at this medication list, and this is my hypothesis. To bar a jury from hearing that, they would need to show that it is unreliable, and they're 0 for 4. You can have 4 times 0, it's still 0.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. If I could...
I'm going to reinstate all of your...
All right.
Your rebuttal time.
I'm not sure. Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to make one more point, then, even if it eats into a little of my rebuttal time.
Go ahead.
That is the thyroid opinion. That stands uncontradicted. Even if you don't accept the diabetes opinion, that Dr. Adelman says if you don't have a thyroid, she took 0.15 milligrams of Synthroid every day to make up for the lack of thyroxine, you slip into a myxoidaceous coma without that medication. And he says, I looked at the autopsy photos, and the distortion and the dissension in her face is consistent with that. They have no answer for that. He should have been able to present that to a jury, and I believe I've already mentioned Dr. Carter. He should have been able to present that to a jury. So we're not asking Your Honors to find that we win. We're asking for a trial. Let the jury decide which pathologist makes more sense.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Lovey. Okay, Ms. Layton, will you add whatever Mr. Lovey just took to Ms. Layton's argument, please? Thank you.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, because defendants had no notice that Ms. Molina had swallowed heroin packets, nor any other reason to suspect that she had an urgent medical need, the district court properly entered summary judgment.
What would happen if she had, upon admission to the jail, said that she had just ingested all this heroin and morphine and everything? What would have happened?
In that case, Your Honor, then there would be notice of something that was amiss with Ms. Molina, and potentially officers in that circumstance would have a duty to take her to the hospital to get treatment.
So it's your position, had she said that, she would have definitely been taken to a hospital.
It's our position that if she had presented the need, and perhaps they would have asked follow-up questions concerning what exactly she meant, whether when she said she swallowed heroin and so forth. But if they had followed up and recognized that there was, in fact, the need, she would have been taken to the hospital.
And take it one step further, had she been taken to the hospital, would that have been a step that would have saved her life?
That we do not know, and plaintiff lacks competent medical expert testimony to establish that.
But I thought that second expert's report did say that when people, I mean, this must happen all the time in the lockup. People are going through drug withdrawal and they get taken to the hospital and there are substances like Narcan that are given to them. And it's not a certainty that the law requires. It's would her odds of survival have improved? So, I mean, this, she can't be the first person with an alleged drug issue.
No, Your Honor.
And you're not telling us that this lockup policy is to screen people and to send for further treatment the diabetics, but to let the drug addicts pass away in the cells.
That is correct, Your Honor. But with respect to Dr. Carter's testimony, on the one hand, it was not admitted by the district court, which was no abuse of discretion.
Well,
but on the other, even if she
that's
had...
That's contested, so we can look...
Sure, sure. And even if it had been considered, her opinion suffered from the same fatal flaws as Dr. Adelman's opinion in that she did not purport to know the amount of heroin. She did not calculate backwards from the amount of heroin found at the time that the autopsy found was in Ms. Molina's system to make any sort of calculation about what amount of heroin would have been in her system, what effect it would have had on a 300-pound woman, what effect... And then how soon she would have had to get to the hospital.
See,
it's simply a guess.
I think those are all the wrong questions to ask. I don't think any of those questions is pertinent because it seems to me the question really has to be simply, was there an evident need for medical attention because something was wrong? If somebody falls on the floor and starts convulsing, you may not know why they're doing that. You may not know if it's a tainted drug or because they have epilepsy or they have something else, but as a layperson, don't you you summon medical help? So I think the district court got off on the wrong track entirely when it started worrying about what was the proximate cause of her death.
Well,
doesn't make any difference.
Well, Your Honor, we see two separate questions. The first question is exactly what Your Honor just said. Is there notice of a reason to get her to the hospital?
Right, and isn't that contested? We have her upon admission saying she has serious medical needs. We have the lawyer's report that she's so distressed that she can't even cooperate with an interview with the lawyer to help for the next day. She's unable to breathe. And we have the other inmate, Vaccarello. We obviously don't judge credibility at the summary judgment stage. So, however, you know, sketchy this woman may have been, that's a credibility issue.
Well, Your Honor, we submit that it's important to examine what each individual defendant knew and when they knew it. Vaccarello
so
did
no
not
imputed knowledge. Nobody reads files from the person who preceded them?
If there was evidence of that effect, the plaintiff had an obligation in response to our summary judgment motion to come forward with that evidence.
So
they
both
did not.
Yeah.
Oh, but
forgive me. You've argued, for instance, that Dr. Adelman's opinion is unreliable because, among other reasons, the medical records that he reviewed to learn about her medical history are dated 6 months before her death. But in the record, is there any suggestion that her condition changed drastically in that six-month period? What if those were the most recent medical records available? And what do you think Dr. Adelman ought to have done to learn about her medical history other than to review those hospital records?
He should have at the very least consulted her treating physician to know what dose she was taking. He
I
did not
know
that.
She had a treating physician. She was indigent.
Because she was getting prescriptions for diabetes medicine. So because he should have at the very least known the dose she was taking and what happened in the hospital a year before in response to what was clearly
a... Can that possibly be a jury question, whether or not he should have, who he should have contacted at that point?
No,
I mean, why are you arguing that he never looked at her medical records? That's just mind-boggling.
We're arguing that he did not look...
Why don't you think the hospital records would have shown the amounts of medication she was given?
Well, the hospital records showed that she was having...
Always show that.
Well, it was showing what medicine that she took was given in the hospital. That
right.
doesn't show what medicine she was taking a year later. She and you know, Your Honor, the answer to your previous question is no, it was not a jury question because the district court is charged with the gatekeeping function under Daubert. And the it, unreliable evidence.
702. It's actually not got superseded years ago.
Correct. Sorry, Your Honor. But it, the death, the, it's the district court's function to assess before it gets to the jury and to weed out the unreliable.
But there was nothing wrong, as I look at Rule 702, with Dr. Edelman's methodologies. He was looking at the kinds of records that experts of this sort normally look at. Nobody says he went to a fly-by-night medical school or whatever. I don't see which part of 702 his at the admissibility stage. I don't want to talk about the weight, but at the admissibility stage, what's your strongest argument for a 702 failure?
Because if you go to the citations that the plaintiff claims regarding the evidence he relied on, it's two things. It's a list of her medicine that it does not say how, what
all
her
the
dose.
Right in front of me. They go on for pages.
But with respect to her medical, the medical evidence. I mean, yes, he reviewed the transcripts of witnesses and so forth. But with respect,
some of which was relevant, you would agree.
Correct. But with respect to the medical evidence he considered, it was the list of her medications, and that did not say the amount that she was taking of each pill. It just said what each pill was and what it did.
And how does her Norwegian hospital medical records, it says her medication list, it says the autopsy report, the toxicology report, the death certificates, the autopsy photos, and then if you go over to that March 6th, lengthy list. You have the hospitalization case report from the police, the death investigation reports.
And how do you deal with the fact that the district court never gave an explanation for barring doctor's opinion? It seems to me that that opinion got overlooked. I mean, even if Dr. Edelman's opinion ought to have been barred, let's say that. She should have been, Ortiz should have been able to rely on Dr. Carter's opinion to prove causation. And, I don't see any justification for that. Look, the case is complicated. The discovery, the discovery schedule was unusual, but the district court's decision not to consider Dr. Carter's opinion that even if she died of opiate intoxication from the swallowing of the narcotics, taking her to the hospital might very well have saved her. I just don't see how I can possibly justify the district court having done what he did with Dr. Carter. It's very troublesome.
Well, Your Honor, we cite a case in which a court has held that it is not inappropriate for a district court not to consider a parade of experts.
Not a parade. Don't you think sentence from the district court explaining why it didn't want to consider Carter? This can't all come from the city.
But the district court said that during the hearing, and there was a transcript district court said, I've already been through this. I'm not quoting verbatim. I'm paraphrasing. I've already been through this with your expert. I put a lot of effort into analyzing 5 expert reports. Dr. Edelman supplemented 5 times. I'm not going to consider another expert. And I think that is a quote. I'm not going to consider another expert.
That's highly unusual. That's highly unusual. The plaintiff is bringing forth another expert, and the court is saying, I'm just not going to look at what that expert said?
Well, within the time limit set for submission of experts, too, it wasn't that it was late.
Right.
He doesn't say you have missed the deadline.
No, the district court says, I've considered, and even considered after barring Dr. Edelman, even considered a supplement after the fact on summary judgment, but drew the line at considering another expert. And we submit the district court is not required to consider expert after expert just because one expert is barred.
The district court may not have been persuaded by Dr. Edelman's opinion, but that is a question for a jury. And the case for Dr. Edelman's opinion, it might be slim. But how can you say a guy like this is unreliable?
Because Dr. Edelman did not know the basic facts he would need to know in order to draw those, opinions.
Your argument was because Dr. Edelman's report in the final analysis failed to establish the proximate cause of her death. That's the theory that the district court went off on. And I would repeat that I think that isn't the right question to ask here, because we don't expect jail officers or other people to be trained doctors. What we do expect is that when somebody's obviously in distress, and we have many cases like that, think of the Gayton case, for example, they are supposed to get the person into the hands of somebody who can do something about
well,
it.
Even the
You're asking the wrong question, I think.
Well, if I may turn to that question, I mean, before I turn to that question, Gayton case itself said that the district court did not abuse its discretion in not considering an expert who did not know what effect taking a particular drug, like a diabetes medication, would have had on an underlying condition. If the expert is not qualified to say that, in this case, Edelman was not, because he did not know the dosage of her medicine or how long she could go without it.
She was looking at that in isolation. I mean, another thing that you seem to regard is of zero value is the fact that 5 to 10 people tried to contact the police department to alert them to the fact that this particular woman did need her medications. The daughter goes and tries to give them. She's rejected because of this no medicine in the lockup rule. But this all goes toward notice that there is a real problem here. And even if the experience of the Chicago police is that sometimes callers are lying, I find it difficult to imagine that we should take the position that they're always lying.
Well, if I may turn, if I may turn to the notice question, Your Honor, because we submit that it is under the Fourth Amendment test, each defendant has to, the facts known to each defendant have to be analyzed separately, because the defendant can't be liable for what other officers knew or did not pass along.
And the district court thought at least two of them knew enough.
And two of them, but those two did not even purport. Even the plaintiff now concedes the only evidence against those two, which are Yost and Gilchrist, was the testimony of Mr. Bischoff, not the testimony of Rice, who was gone from the lockup by the time Yost and Gilchrist started.
Why is Mr. Bischoff's testimony so lacking that a jury can't see it? I mean, he's shocked at his client's condition.
We submit that the Fourth Amendment requires analyzing the circumstances known to the officer, and the officers, Yost and Gilchrist, had literally several minutes of contact with Ms. Molina. From the time they woke her up, they had never met her before. Mr. Bishop had. He was her attorney. He'd met her before, and his testimony reflects that he thought that she looked different than he'd seen her in the past. Yost and Gilchrist did not have that basis of comparison.
But he just says to them, this woman belongs in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the problem. Your view is that they should ignore input from people and instead prefer their own glance.
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. Not that they should ignore, but not that they are not, that whether they should consider turns on all of the facts known to them. And so, because they had literally met her for several minutes, as they walked her from her cell after she'd just woken up, an obese woman who required a walker to walk, they testified they did not hear her having trouble speaking or breathing. In fact, even Mr. Bischoff testified, and I quote, it wasn't to the point where she could not breathe, and that's at R-233-2
well,
at 13.
That point is you're dead, I think.
Well, that she was having rapid breathing, but not that she couldn't breathe. And so he thought she looked different than he'd seen her in the past. And Yost and Gilchrist did not have a basis to make that conclusion. So when Mr. Bischoff said to them, I think she's sick, they literally seen her for 3 minutes, they closed the door, 10-minute interview, and then they saw him through the glass for several seconds at which he said that. That did not put them on notice of an urgent need to get her to the hospital then. And we submit the need has to be urgent.
Isn't that taking the light and the evidence mm-hmm. and the light most favorable to the city? We have to take it the other way. And when he says to them she belongs in the hospital, there's no reason for us to think he means next week. I mean, he knows she's going to go to the lockup soon.
You have to take the evidence to light. That we certainly agree that the inference from that is he thought she needed to get to the hospital. The question is whether that would have put them on notice of a need to take her to the hospital. Just because the attorney says it doesn't mean it's true.
Did they read admission records? Did they read this form that the other person...
No, Your Honor. They were not the ones who came during the intake. That was different officers.
But do you throw them in the wastebasket once these records are created?
No, Your Honor. The intake records go to the front desk. The lockup keepers are not at the front desk. They are charged with keeping order in the lockup.
So what's the point of putting anything down in the intake record, since according to you, the way the lockup is operated is that the people watching the prisoners have absolutely no knowledge of any conversation that happened on intake?
Well, Your Honor, we submit that there is a short time period in which the police are charged with the...
But is that your position, that the people that, you know, you sort of engage in the useless exercise of writing things down at the time of intake, but you make sure that nobody further in contact with the prisoners knows what's been put down?
No, we submit that we use that information at the time, but then we rely on notice.
But you don't tell the officers in charge of actually supervising the inmates what's put on the form.
Well, that of course
walled off from them.
That of course gets to a question regarding a policy of the city. And as plaintiffs,
I just want to know whether that's what happened here.
There is no evidence that Yost and Gilchrist went to look at the intake form. That's correct. They did not in this particular case. But the question is whether they had a constitutional duty to check back with it, as opposed to the facts and circumstances that were known to them, and whether those facts and circumstances put them on notice. There's a short time period that officers are charged with detainees, the responsibility for detainees. And in fact, there's a tension between their constitutional duty to process detainees quickly for a Gerstein hearing, that's the other claim in this case. So
no,
there's
the other
a tension.
Claim in this case is, why did they choose that particular morning to input all of her paper records into the computer?
Well, Your Honor, that is not the two defendants that are left on that claim. That was not Diemba or Lemon Redmond.
All right, so I have a question for you about them. Under the rules that govern the lockup, how does it work? Is there like a checklist that they need, you know, fingerprints checked, processing done, and then once that checklist is complete, they are the people who say, okay, inmate X is ready to go for the bond hearing, or do they have to await an order from somebody else saying, okay, officers, you know, I, Lieutenant somebody or whatever, am now allowing you to release the person? How does it work?
The evidence in this case shows that when the detainee comes in, then the information from her fingerprints are sent somewhere else, not the lockup,
right.
To get checked.
Okay, all of that's done by 12-12.
Right, and that's when it comes back.
At that moment, were these two officers the ones with the authority to review the file and say, now she's ready to go?
Correct.
Or did they have to get authorization from somebody else?
Well, at 12:12 p.m., they had what they needed to start the process. The record does not show whether they needed to go and ask the supervisor then or some other step beyond that. There's no dispute that at 12:12 p.m., they had what they needed. Our position is that
they could have started the wheels rolling.
At 12:12 p.m., they could have started the wheels rolling, but at that point, she had missed the bond call for that day already, and the plaintiff has the burden to show that a detention less than 48 hours is unreasonable.
It's a burden of proof shift. That's all that Riverside does. So despite the evidence from this criminal defense attorney, it's the city's position that there's one and only one bond hearing in the city of Chicago, which happens at 10:30 in the morning for felonies in one place?
That was the bond call that she could have been taken to that day, and that officers Ziemba and Lemon
Redmond.
There's
evidence in the record to show that actually the city doesn't have only one bond call at 10:30.
That was the
day.
Felony bond call. There is no evidence.
That's what I'm saying.
There's no evidence in the record that there was another bond call that they could have taken her to. That there was testimony from Mr. Bischoff, but he did not purport to know that the other call he referred to was in fact a felony bond call. The plaintiffs had the burden to submit evidence that they unreasonably delayed. But they went off duty an hour later, and there is no evidence that they intentionally were dragging their feet or doing anything to prevent her from getting processed for another bond hearing, if in fact there was another bond hearing she could have gone to. If I just may, I see my time is submitted. If I may just briefly urge the court to, when considering the notice question, to look carefully at the actual evidence against each of the defendants to make the analysis as to whether any of them had the notice that she needed to get to the hospital. That Vaccarello did not talk about distress and needing medicine. Vaccarello testified she wanted to make a phone call. And we submit that there's a difference between asking for a phone call and asking to go to the hospital to take medicine. So we just urge the court to pay careful attention to what each officer knew. And with respect to Adelman, we just urge the court to look carefully at what he actually knew. And even if his testimony should have been admissible, we submit that for the most part, the only officers at which that could go for would be officers Yost and Gilchrist, but even they did not have the requisite notice. So for these reasons, we ask the court to affirm the district court.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Lovey.
So cutting to it, the question really is, what's your best argument? Why is this unreliable? His methodology is good. He's done this 1,000 times. He has 40 years' experience, got a great resume. Why is this unreliable? And there is no answer. She says, well, the medical records are 6 months old. You know, a lot of pathologists give opinions that are admissible in court without looking at medical records at all. Sometimes
Okay, I'm sorry.
And, you know, further on that point, the district court just got it wrong. The district court said he didn't look at the medical records at all. Dr. Adelman did know the doses. The glucotrol, 10 milligrams daily, the furosemide, 80 milligrams twice daily, the potassium chloride daily.
Can I stop you? Because we got that point.
All right.
Let's talk about the burden to show that the delay was unreasonable. That falls on Ortiz, and the evidence seems to be just conjecture from Mr. Bischoff, who is Molina's lawyer. There's really no suggestion that the city was deliberately holding her in jail in order to avoid a probable cause hearing. And to me, that argument really sounded a lot like the argument that we rejected in Portis versus City of Chicago, that just because the city has a lot of courts and a lot of police officers, a detainee must be rushed, you know, before a judge at the earliest possible convenience.
Your Honors, we're making a Fourth Amendment argument, and the only question is, did the district court abuse its discretion in agreeing with us that they acted unreasonably? If a lawyer says, I interacted with her for less than 10 minutes, and it's obvious to me she can't talk to me, she's in distress, I asked her, are you a diabetic not getting your medicines? He's a layperson.
Well,
she figured it out.
I was asking about the Gerstein.
Exactly.
On the Gerstein point.
No, you're right, and I'm about to interrupt you yet again.
Let's talk about the Gerstein.
I hate interrupting people. Go ahead.
They acknowledge that at the absolute latest, by noon on the middle day, she was ready to go. And, you know, there's a debate whether she should have had to wait for them to do the inputting. But those two defendants should have started the process moving to get her to court. Instead, on the next calendar day, she dies in her cell. They have no explanation for what she's still doing there.
But why is it their burden to offer
it's
that
yours.
Explanation? Why didn't you need to call around the various City of Chicago courts and find out who was having felony hearings that afternoon?
All right, I finally
you
caught
could
up.
Have
yeah, how many, you know, like how many judges are available for a probable cause hearing at any given time? How far in advance does such a hearing need to be scheduled? And, you know, and is there any evidence at all in this case that the city delayed bringing her before a judge to avoid a probable cause hearing?
Well, to answer the last part, we don't have to show that they did it to avoid a probable cause. We just have to show that they had, you know, that they delayed. And the Gerstein hearing is you have a right to be brought to a magistrate. To answer the first part of the question, Bischoff says, I am a longtime criminal defense attorney. I've been doing this for 20 years. And his testimony was they could have brought her to a bond hearing that afternoon.
Well,
now,
look, the evidence was just conjecture from Mr. Bischoff, right?
Well, then we respectfully, you know, disagree that doesn't sound like conjecture. That sounds like evidence.
Okay, but I really want an answer to my question. And my question is there any suggestion that the city was deliberately holding her in jail to avoid a probable cause hearing?
I
want a yes or no.
I would say no. No, I agree with you. There's no deliberate. You know, nobody said, let's screw her out of her bond hearing. But the Constitution requires, if there's no justification to keep holding them, not to keep holding them. And I believe we've shown that claim. So to answer in fairness, we can't prove they deliberately said, let's screw her out of her bond hearing. But they still violated the Constitution. And even
well,
if
the
it
remedy
wasn't,
for that is to exclude anything that the evidence that arises after the in the interval before she's brought to court?
Well, in the Portis litigation, which actually we were a part of, the court also recognized there is a civil remedy, and that it deters and that helps the system to work. Portis said we're not going to let that civil remedy go on a class-wide basis. So if you have an individual case where they can't justify holding you, bring that case and you have a civil claim.
Well, look, we've got a 48-hour threshold that the Supreme Court has established.
Well, 48.
We've got about 30 hours here. No, it's true that even delays of less than 48 hours it can be unconstitutional if there's not sufficient justification. But the record here is just not well developed.
No, isn't the record that the city isn't disputing anymore? They had no reason to hold her after noon on the middle day. They have an off. There was no reason to hold her. That much is undisputed. And we try to push it back even earlier on the middle day because the paperwork inputting shouldn't have mattered. But nobody is debating that they had no business holding her after noon on the middle day. That's established. Now, the burden is actually on them to explain why they allowed to continue holding her. You're right. We have to show some evidence that they could have brought her to court sometime after mid-morning on the middle day. But we did have that evidence. We have Jerry Bischoff, who says, I'm an experienced lawyer, I've been doing this a long time, and in the city of Chicago, there is a mechanism for a bond hearing, and that evidence should have got us to trial. Even if it's not against those two defendants, Lemon and the other one, we have the stipulation, and that's the site I gave you before, the record at 214 has the transcript, pages 3 to 5. The city says, because we had a devil of a time trying to figure out who is it that's going to take responsibility for not getting her to court. Every deposition, the person's saying, not me, you got to talk to my supervisor. We wanted to do the Monell policy discovery to show it doesn't matter whose fault it was, the city's got a bad policy. And in lieu of that, the city said, if you prove a constitutional violation, we'll stand behind it.
Will what?
We'll stand behind the constitutional violation. We will stipulate the judgment. We've spent a lot of time on the over-detention. I just want to get back to the main claim. We didn't hear a word about the thyroid claim. That is a freestanding opinion that is sufficient to get us to a jury. They can't, just by downplaying it, does not make it go away. The Dr. Carter opinion, we met the deadline. There was an agreed motion that the attorneys signed, and we said, let's have time to finish the discovery and do experts. We met the non-extended deadline, and the district court never said otherwise. They want to rely on that one phrase. I urge your honors to take a look at our reply brief if there's any question. It's all laid out. The district court, and 2 pages later, said this is very confused. We had already disclosed Dr. Carter at the time the district court got frustrated. You know, the case got messed up because they talked the district court into fast-tracking it to summary judgment. They said to the district court, heroin, summary judgment, and he's, you know, people prejudge things, judges are human, but the judge also said, and it's a footnote in our reply, we've made a mess of this case, and that is not plaintiff's fault. The last issue I want to talk about here is the notice. You know,
we have very little time to do it because you've now gotten, believe it or not, more time than you originally had. I can't believe it.
Then I will be succinct.
Okay.
Notice is the last thing they should be going for. I mean, the district court agreed with us that at least some defendants had notice. You got prisoners saying they're telling us to shut the F up. You got lawyers begging for the hospitalization. Our reply brief lays out the case why particular defendants had actual notice, and we stand on that. But they're not getting anywhere with that. Even the district court agreed with us. This is a jury trial, and this family asks for that relief. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both Mr. Lovey and Ms. Layton for a really well-argued case. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement. And thanks very, very much.